I'm with Philip Norman, author of John Lennon, The Life. Philip, there's been so much written about John Lennon, notably by yourself in your book, Shout, The True Story of the Beatles. Why did you feel the need to write this new book?
I felt that John was such a towering figure of the late 20th century, not just as a musician, of course that's very important, but as a writer, as an artist, even as a rather visionary thinker. His work in the field of peace activism now is something pop stars just do almost routinely, but in those days it was considered very eccentric and very wayward. There were so many ways in which John influenced the late 20th century. I felt that in Shout, I'd obviously done a collective portrait of the Beatles, and that was a sketch of John. This had to be a full-length portrait in oils. I must say as well that although lots is written about John Lennon all the time, there had only been two sort of full-scale biographies before, if you want to call them that, one by Albert Goldman, which is pretty much sort of dismissible on every level, another one by Ray Coleman, who used to know John and was a music journalist, which I felt was a good attempt, but really didn't sort of cover the ground, didn't get John between hard covers. This enormous personality, was a tremendous challenge to capture, obviously, in all his facets and contradictions. So that was really why.
And you attempted in this book to cast away your own preconceptions about John Lennon and write really a book for people who may not know anything about him.
I think this is a good way to approach any non-fiction subject, yes, to sort of start with a completely sort of blank canvas. There were certain things that I'd written in Shout that I did have to revise, notably the relationship with Paul McCartney. I think I underestimated McCartney in Shout, which I've tried to redress in this book. There were certain facts. I talked to John's Aunt Mimi, the woman who brought him up, and who gave him a home, a tremendously good home, when he was a boy. She was absolutely certain that he was born during a heavy air raid on Liverpool in 1940, when I actually did look up the records of the Watch Committee about the raids at that time. That was the one night of that week of heavy raids when the German Luftwaffe did not bomb Liverpool. So, yes, I had to revise even matters of fact.
Mimi was one of the people who had a massive influence on John Lennon's life, but it wasn't a warm relationship, was it?
It wasn't, although Mimi absolutely loved him. She was quite a sort of, quite a brisk, almost sort of rather masculine figure. She wasn't a sort of maternal figure. She wanted a boy, and she really adored John from the moment of seeing him as a baby. She didn't really want to have children of her own. She was a bit like Betsy Trotwood in David Copperfield, fantastically good heart and conscientious woman, but didn't actually give John the sort of warm feminine affection that he seemed to need. And his mother Julia had handed John to her sister Mimi to bring up. She was in John's life. She was very, very pretty, very, very funny, very eccentric. And she lived very close to where Mimi was bringing up John. John saw a lot of his mother throughout his childhood. He tended to downplay this later on so that nothing would detract from Mimi's, achievement in raising him. But John always felt that his mother really didn't belonged to him because she was living with another man and had two children with another man. So John was always somehow looking for this, this soft maternal, affection, even though he, in many respects, his childhood was happy and even quite privileged.
Although he made it clear in songs such as Mother that he expressed his belief that he wasn't wanted as a child, in fact, you make it quite clear that he was very much wanted by a lot of people.
Yes, John always thought he wasn't wanted by his father, Alfred Lennon, who was a merchant sailor. And in fact, his father did want him and wanted to keep the home together because during one of Alfred's absences during the war, John's mother, Julia, did become pregnant by a soldier stationed in Liverpool at the time. Alfred was willing to forgive her and adopt the baby and keep the home together. Alfred only really turned over John to his mother, John's mother, because he thought John would have a better time. At one stage, Alfred wanted to take John away to New Zealand to start a new life. Then there was John's uncle also wanted to adopt him. His Aunt Mimi wanted him. There were people queuing up, sort of almost fighting over this baby. It wasn't a question of not being wanted.
Astrid Kircher, Stuart Sutcliffe's girlfriend, told you that the death of John Lennon's mother outside his home in 1958 was at the root of his anger.
That's true. I think he was a fairly aggressive character anyway, although John is a mass of contradictions, and he's aggressive, but he's also quite gentle and vulnerable at the same time. Yes, John's mother was knocked down by a car and killed outside his Aunt Mimi's house, and that did, yes, cause him tremendous pain, which he never got over, really. There was a sort of fascination that John had for his mother, which psychologists say is not at all uncommon in a boy who doesn't actually live with his mother, and almost a kind of sexual allure that she had. And there was one moment when John even wondered if there might have been a sexual encounter between them. Then the death of Julia, of course, took her away just at the moment when John really felt he was getting to know her and to appreciate her as a person. And for the rest of his life, he was obsessed with the memory of his mother and obsessed with this kind of sexual fascination as well, right up until the last month of his own life.
Another person who was... John Lennon did lose quite a lot of people who were close to him during his life. Stuart Sutcliffe was another. And you give some credence to the view that a fight with John Lennon, between John Lennon and Stuart Sutcliffe... it could have been that had an effect on Stuart Sutcliffe's eventual death from a brain hemorrhage.
Well, I had to consider this possibility because Stuart's sister made that allegation, Pauline Sutcliffe. But I think on balance, it couldn't have happened. The only alleged witness to this alleged attack by John on Stuart was Paul McCartney, who has absolutely no memory of it whatsoever. Also, the reason was supposed to be John's frustration with the fact that Stuart was a poor musician. He was playing bass guitar in the Beatles at the time, but actually at that point Stuart was virtually out of the Beatles. That wasn't an issue anymore. And John had always defended Stuart, and actually had come to his rescue when he was attacked by some yobs in Liverpool sometime before. John had actually broken his own finger in fighting off these attackers. So I just really, in the end, I can't sort of believe that really happened.
Paul McCartney, obviously, a very important figure in John Lennon's life. You interviewed him via email for this new book. I was interested that, especially in the latter years of John Lennon's of the Beatles' career, their relationship was a professional one, really, rather than one of close friends.
I think it always really was a professional one, and that was of course, a terribly close bond. You know, that young boys who liked rock and roll in the 50s in Britain were the sort of part of a kind of secret society. You know, you were bonded with other people because the adult world was so against it and was, persecuting you for liking rock and roll. And they were so addicted to it and so infatuated. And then they start writing songs and they realize they have this ability to write together. That's, the professional bond was an incredibly strong bond. They were very different, as characters. They always had the highest regard for one another as musicians. And, you cannot get better than that in a relationship, quite honestly. If they'd been great friends, but then had hated what each was doing musically. John might have criticized Paul's sort of softer melodic music, but John liked soft melodic music. John could write a song just as sort of sentimental as anything Paul would come up with. And it's interesting that even when the Beatles were falling out and John and Paul were disagreeing over things like Yoko and who should manage the Beatles and all that, when John wanted someone to help him record the Ballad of John and Yoko, he turned to Paul. He would always turn to Paul for advice about music, even if they couldn't agree on anything else.
You're quoted, Philip, in Malcolm Gladwell's recent book, Outliers, saying that the Beatles wouldn't have been the group that we know had it not been for the crucible of Hamburg. How important was Hamburg to the Beatles?
It really was. It gave them this extraordinary stamina. And if you consider what they went through as the Beatles, the awful pressure of the fame that the Beatles had, part of what helped them withstand that was the kind of unity they forged when they were playing virtually sort of all night in these clubs in Hamburg. I think it also sort of gave them something musically as well. You know, it gave them a sort of not only a cohesion, it just gave them a something else, some sort of European sort of element to their music, something that wasn't quite the same as, you know, the groups on Merseyside at the time, and not quite the same as just doing American cover versions.
You get as close as I imagine anyone ever will to discovering the truth about what happened when John Lennon went on holiday to Spain with the Beatles manager Brian Epstein. What do you think happened?
Put very crudely, he might have given Brian a blowjob. He might have. It wouldn't have meant anything to, you know, John would do something like that. It wouldn't mean that John was gay. You know, he might have done that. I think Brian hinted to his own good friend Peter Brown that's what had happened. Initially, John, according to Brian, told to me by Yoko eventually, John had said to Brian that if it would help Brian, encourage Brian to be a better manager, John was quite willing to sleep with Brian. You know, he was so ambitious at the time. Again, it wouldn't have meant that John wasn't totally straight. He was just ambitious. But Brian was too good a person, too nice a person to take advantage of that. Finally, when they go to Spain, Brian sort of does give in and sort of confesses, you know, his infatuation with John to John. The actual trip, the motivation, is mostly explained by John sort of thinking that he's the chief Beatle and he goes off to Spain on holiday with the manager to discuss strategy. It's the sign that he's the leader. John was not averse to sort of playing around on the edge of campness either. He was quite interested in, you know, what happened in gay male society in those days when, of course, it was still illegal in Britain to be a male, you know, to have any gay male relationship.
You make the interesting point that at the height of Beatlemania, the only place that the group could get any privacy was in the recording studio.
That's true. The recording studio, when the Beatles started, was like a laboratory. People came in, they did what they were told. Men in white coats, like lab technicians, told them when, you know, where to sit and what to play and all the rest of it. They made so much money for EMI that eventually the studios became like their private domain, with George Martin, who was amazingly sympathetic and empathetic producer. And it did become a sort of refuge, yes, for them, and to get away from the madness of Beatlemania and everything, and to work on their music. And the studios were just open to them whenever they wanted to do it.
It must have been quite hard for the other Beatles to cope with the presence of Yoko Ono in the studio, because up until then, you know, the Beatles, it had been a sort of a place just for them, and you know, wives and girlfriends were forbidden. And I think Yoko does come across as quite a sympathetic character in your book.
Well, I've tried to make her, I think she is in many respects a very misunderstood figure. And when Yoko first went into the studio with the Beatles, John's idea was that Yoko should join the Beatles. She should become a Beatle. What is really surprising is how patient the other three were with this for quite a while. It wasn't like an open revolt saying you can't have any women in the studio. They thought John would get over this, but of course he didn't.
The post-Beatles years is some of the most interesting passages in the book. How do you regard John Lennon's post-Beatles career? Because, I mean, in terms of recorded output, it is pretty patchy. On the other hand, there are some fantastic records that he made during that time.
Yes, he also had pretty much instantaneous success as a solo performer. It took Paul McCartney much, much longer to get going eventually with Wings in the 70s, right from sort of 69, when, you know, the breakup is sort of starting, if not sort of complete. John is having, you know, success in the charts as John Lennon and with the Plastic Ono Band. And I think that every album he made was terrific. And the one that had the worst critical reception, which is Sometime in New York City, which is full of polemics, you know, about American radicals and black power and all that. I think it has wonderful stuff on it. And I think John and Yoko together on that album are brilliant as well. It's usually thought that Yoko, you know, got into White Sacks and screeched, and that was it. But she didn't. You know, she was a classically trained musician. There are a couple of vocals on Sometime in New York City with John and Yoko that are terrific.
It's quite interesting as well. They made these series of experimental records in the early 70s, and but then suddenly he kind of, his commercial antennae prick up, and he thinks, having commercial success was always something that was important to him, even when he was experimenting and making avant-garde recordings.
Yes, and of course the Beatles were very arty and very experimental, even as the Beatles, and they're sort of listening to music concrete and stuff like that in the mid-60s, and John Cage is an influence. Revolution Number 9, which was said to be electronic gibberish on the White Album, is now very seriously sort of considered. But John, yes, particularly after the retirement, even when he renounces the music business, that half of him is renouncing it and half of it is wishing he was still up there, battling it out with Bob Dylan and Mick Jagger and all the rest. So when he comes back, after the retirement with a Double Fantasy, it's not only a very sort of commercial, very personal, like it would be, it's a lot of it sounds like McCartney. But of course he always did. He could sound like McCartney. McCartney could sound like Lennon. That was the secret.
He was a very different father to Sean Lennon, the boy he had with Yoko, than he was to Julian, the son that he had with Cynthia.
Yes, his deficiencies as a father with his first son Julian, you can't get around it. It was awful, particularly as John had grown up feeling that he lacked a father, and so then Julian grew up feeling that he lacked a father. It was because John was just getting famous with the Beatles. He was always away, touring with them, playing on the road. He had not wanted, really, to get married to Julian's mother, Cynthia. He did it because she was pregnant. That's what young men tended to do in those days in the early 60s. But he was an absentee father to Julian. Later on, he wanted to have a child with Yoko, their son, Sean. Was really parented until the age of five by John. He was five when John was killed, but he has the most vivid memories of very, very loving sort of father figure in his life.
And Sean's memories form the closing chapter of your book. And it's fascinating. It's a portrait of John that we recognise from having read the rest of the book.
Yes, John was still John, despite those years in America and despite having gone through all the therapy. Even when John was sort of being assailed by all these kind of things like meditation, which tended to make most people very boring, it made George Harrison very boring, John was never boring, John was still John. And yes, this father figure is sort of, clowning around and being funny, for this little boy, as well as being very close and loving.
And Sean really got to know John to a large extent as an older boy through his recordings.
That's true. He didn't really understand about the Beatles, and it wasn't something that John was kind of wearing on his sleeve very much, at the end of the 70s. So then Sean grows up feeling that the world knows more about John, his father, than he, Sean, knows. And becoming a musician himself is one of the ways of getting closer to John, particularly playing the piano. And actually, Sean is a very, very good musician, but not at all like John. But he has an absolutely sort of, total kind of, admiration for John and John as a musician and John's work, which he's able to express very, very sort of clearly and vividly. He said to me he thought that when John moved from the Beatles to the Plastic Ono Band, that was like Matisse giving up painting interiors and going into paper cutouts. He's absolutely right, actually. That's just what it's like.
It's almost three decades now since John Lennon died. How do you regard the way the Beatles' back catalogue and John Lennon's recorded work have been managed over the last three decades?
Well, for a long, long time, they were very, very well managed because the person in charge of Apple was Neil Aspinall, who was their close friend and the Beatles' close friend and their roadie, and the person who never sold them out was always loyal. I don't know what's going to happen now. Neil Aspinall left Apple and, of course, unfortunately died last year. So who knows? But it, you know, it has not been sort of bastardized to this point. That's all one can say.
Paul McCartney recently raised the prospect that Carnival of Light, which was a 15-minute recording, experimental recording they made in early 1967, might be commercially released. What's your view of that?
Well, everything is going to be commercially released, you know, over the years. They left such a huge amount of marvellous stuff behind in a very short career. Of course it will come out, yes, and it will be picked over by scholars, and of course it will be treated with tremendous reverence, where at the time they would have said, oh, the Beatles are going potty.
Ringo Starr recently said that he wasn't going to sign any more autographs. What do you make of that? I was interested that Paul McCartney sprang to his defence.
Interesting that Paul sprang to Ringo's defence, because they don't really get on anymore, the two of them. I think it was very stupid of Ringo. He's a very graceless character these days. He was always the one who had the sort of charm and knew what to say. You know, the one great thing in his life, the one stroke of luck, was becoming a Beatle and not very much talent. You know, he was just around at the right moment. And now to sort of do that, make those silly sort of automatic peace signs and say, I'm not, you know, really sort of sod off to the fans, I think is stupid.
And Beatles always in the headlines, of course. And a Vatican newspaper at the end of last year said it was forgiving John Lennon for his remark in 1966 that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus. I thought that was extraordinary. What did you think?
It was extraordinary because when John made the remark, the Vatican did not condemn him. There was no fatwa from the Catholic Church on John Lennon at all. There was a mild sort of reproof in a Vatican newspaper at the time. The real religious backlash against that was in America and wasn't at all in, you know, from Rome. So I can't think why this ceremonial forgiveness had to be announced.
Philip Norman, many thanks.
Thank you.